morning. If we can have order in the room, welcome to Business and Labor. I'll just remind everyone, like I always do, to please, if you have cell phones, please silence them. We have a wonderful breakfast up here up front for the committee. Thank you, Ms. Wiggers. That was due to cell phone violation yesterday, so please silence those cell phones. Members, we are going to continue our educational process today. We are going to hear first from the Sergeant at Arms on some safety protocols. Second, we're going to hear from the Banking Commissioner, and then we'll hear from the Department of Labor. Afterwards, we'll go into our bill hearing process. Our bill hearing order will be House Bill 120 by Representative Minor, followed by House Bill 30 by Representative Buckley, House Bill 41, Representative Bergstrom, and House Bill 67, Representative Nickel. After we have our hearings, we will go into executive action, and we'll try to undertake some executive action. Any question on that from the committee members? Okay, let's start the meeting. We'll ask Sergeant at Arms Johnson to please come forward and give the committee a safety briefing. Sergeant. Oh, I think we can start with roll call. Thank you, Representative Fitzgerald. You're on my list already.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vice Chair Seekins-Grohe.
Here.
Vice Chair Harvey.
Here.
Representative Anderson.
Here.
Representative Bergstrom.
Here.
Representative Carter.
Here.
Representative Fitzgerald.
Here.
Representative Galloway.
Here.
Representative Gist.
Here.
Representative Gunderson.
Here.
Representative Carlin.
Here.
Representative Logie.
Here.
Representative Lynch.
Here.
Representative Marshall.
Here.
Here.
Representative Nickel.
Here.
Representative Oblender.
Here.
Representative Sullivan.
Here.
Representative Solnikov.
Here.
And Chair Buttry.
Here. Thank you. We have a quorum. Just another reminder also for the committee, if you have proxy forms that you haven't completed and turned in, please get those to the vice chairs or the member that you've designated to hold those proxies. All right, Sergeant at Arms Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good morning. My name is Trent Johnson. I'm a Sergeant at Arms for this committee of the 2023 session. A little about me. I'm an armor officer in the Montana Army National Guard of the 163rd Combined Arms Brigade. I majored in international studies, and I majored in sports and exercise psychology. I'm excited to work for you all. A big part of my duties includes response to various situations within the Capitol. This includes events and emergencies in our committee room. I'd like to briefly cover our action plan for this room itself. In the event that the chairman decides to clear the room, I would utilize both doors to channel all members out of the room, while also attending to the conflicting situation, like a uncooperative proponent or opponent. Based on the general consensus of the situation, the committee will split and meet at their corresponding bullpens in the basement level, room 10 and 64. In the event of the situation, when it comes to an emergency situations, there are different procedures we plan to follow. I'd like to first notate the exit zones in this room, the two main doors. Let's see. We would exit the room and head west to the main entrance. That is the primary exit location. Following that, we also have the two doors on the east side, heading north and west. Those are our secondary exit. And if it happens to, in specific circumstances, the windows can be used as well. They both open, and it's a flat, level ground. Let's see. For an active shooter situation, our first priority would be to escape. If I deem it necessary that we must seek place in shelter, we utilize the two offices in the back, as well as taking shelter under the desks. Let's see. We will also be blocking up the hydraulic pistons using items such as belts and using tables and chairs to board up the doors. When it comes to the situation regarding fire, that will also be one of the points that we use my mentioned outlets to get out. Essentially, by primarily utilizing the routes shown on the map and what we spoke about, there is little room for error. But I'm very excited to work for everybody in the 2023 session. If you need anything at all, please feel free to ask me.
Thank you, Sergeant at Arms. Are there any questions from the committee members for Sergeant at Arms Johnson? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do we have Banking Commissioner Hall in the room? Okay, thank you. We are now going to have a presentation to the committee from the Banking Commissioner.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Melanie Hall, and I am the Commissioner of the Division of Banking and Financial Institutions, which is part of the Department of Administration, which is kind of odd because the rest of the Department of Administration is internal-facing state government, but for some reason, also the banking division. I have been in this role since January of 2011. A little bit about my background. I have a law degree from Tulane and a degree in economics from a small college in Florida, Eckerd College. The Division of Banking has specific statutory authority for regulating financial service providers that do business in Montana, as set forth by the legislature in certain parts of Title 31 and all of Title 32. The division currently charters and regulates 36 state chartered banks with assets of $76 billion and 10 state chartered credit unions with assets of $3.5 billion. As a point of reference, when I became commissioner 12 years ago, the division oversaw almost twice as many state chartered banks. However, their combined assets was only one quarter of the total assets the division supervises today. This is largely due to some of our larger banks acquiring banks in other states, and some of our banks now have branches all over the Pacific, the Mountain West, really. The division regulates depository institutions that vary significantly in size, from as large as First Interstate Bank with assets of over $30 billion to as small as Montana Educators Credit Union in Missoula with assets of $25 million. As part of the division's supervision of depositories, the division examines banks and credit unions on a regular schedule based on size, complexity, and prior rating of the institution, but typically anywhere from every 6 months to every 18 months. The division assesses the institution's capital or equity position, their asset quality, which is the quality of the loans and securities that they have on their books, their earnings, their liquidity, the level of interest rate risk they are taking based on the level of risk and length of maturity of their assets, their information technology and cybersecurity practices, their compliance with anti-money laundering laws, and their overall risk management practices, including the experience and qualifications of their boards and management teams. The division also licenses and regulates over 1,000 non-depository financial service companies and currently licenses 4,400 individual mortgage loan originators doing business in Montana. Some of the non-depository companies the division regulates operate nationally, such as Rocket Mortgage, which if you watch any football, you've certainly seen the commercials, and OneMain Financial. Some also operate small mortgage brokerages in towns all over Montana, and one of your colleagues in the House is a licensee of the office. Of note, at the high point in July of 2021, the division had over 7,000 licensed loan originators. This drop from 7,000 to 4,400 in loan originators is reflective of rising interest rates and less activity, significantly less activity in the mortgage refinance market. As any of you who have mortgages probably did over the past few years, you hopefully refinance them into much lower rates. And I don't think anybody's going to be refinancing into higher rates if they can avoid it over the next few years. The laws the division enforces can be complex, as the determination of which laws apply to what companies and the division's enforcement and supervision powers depend on the type of company and the activities it is engaged in. For instance, Montana is currently the only state in the country that does not license money transmitters, so like Western Union. Hence, the division does not license or examine PayPal for their money transmission activities, but the division does license PayPal as an escrow company for the specific business of holding funds until the occurrence of a specified event. Additionally, most of you have probably heard about the bankruptcy of the crypto company FTX. As noted, the division did not license FTX for its money transmission or cryptocurrency businesses, as we have no such license. However, the division did license FTX as a consumer lender because FTX was also engaged in the practice of loaning fiat currency, real dollars, to consumers. To be clear, that license has been suspended. Although I won't go into detail on the division's bills, since this isn't a hearing on any of them, although there will be one in a moment, the division does have four bills that will come in front of the committee this session, three of which include provisions that support the governor's red tape relief initiatives. And one of those bills, the one that will start in the Senate, the other three start here, is a complete repeal bill of a law that has been on the books for 15 years and has never once been used. In closing, I simply want to offer that I'm available to come provide any information the committee would like from the banking division, data, whatever you need, concerning any financial service bills that end up before you. I suspect, based on the LCs that I have seen thus far, that there could be quite a few bills concerning the world of banking this session, and to the extent that the division can provide helpful information, we are happy to do so. If there are any questions from the committee at this time, I'd be happy to answer them. If not, best wishes for a productive 68th session.
Thank you, Ms. Hall. And members of the committee, I can personally attest that Ms. Hall is an amazing resource for financial matters, so please utilize her as you see fit. Are there any questions from the committee for Commissioner Hall? Great. Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Members, we should have someone here from Department of Labor. Oh, good. We'll now have a presentation to the committee from the Department of Labor.
Good morning, Chair Buttrey, committee members. My name is Lori Esau. That's E-S-A-U. I serve as Montana's Commissioner of Labor and Industry. I have with me this morning a few members of my leadership team, and we are happy to answer any questions you may have. But first, I wanted to give you all a high-level overview of the services we provide. You've been given, or you're being given, two documents today, one which is just a general overview of the department and our structure, and the other one is our strategic accomplishments over the last 2 years. DLI currently has about 750 FTEs spread across Montana. We are 98% non-general fund. The vast majority of our funding comes either from federal revenue or a state special fund. Across DLI's three customer-facing divisions, we touch and impact nearly every corner of Montana's economy in some way. Our Workforce Services division plays a key role in connecting job seekers and employers. Our 17 job service Montana offices provide a host of services to local Montanans and businesses by being right there in the community they serve. WSD also provides important upskilling and training programs. We're particularly proud of our growth in registered apprenticeships over the last 2 years. By making apprenticeships available to more employers, we've seen dramatic growth in the apprenticeship program. More apprentices were enrolled in 2022 than any year before, and there are more workers in active apprenticeships today than ever in Montana. Importantly, this growth hasn't just come in typical sectors when you hear of apprenticeships like plumbing, carpentry. IT, healthcare, and manufacturing are all playing a role in the growth of these apprenticeship occupations. WSD has gone through a significant reorg in the last year, and we feel the finished product will lead to better coordination, more efficiency, and improved customer service. As a result of this organization, or reorganization, DLI has been able to reduce the division's FTE count by 25 for the coming year. This year, DLI has a new division that may be unfamiliar to you. Our Employment Standard Divisions is the result of a merger of our Business Standards and our Employment Relations Division. DLI undertook this merger to combine two similarly tasked divisions, and we hope to see meaningful operational efficiencies in the months and years to come. ESD provides a wide array of services to protect both the worker and the customer. We investigate and adjudicate human rights and discrimination claims. We set and monitor standards in building codes and in commercial weights and measures. And we enforce Montana's workers' compensation and wage and hour laws. ESD also manages much of Montana's occupational and professional licensing. And reforming the licensure process is part of the governor's red tape relief initiative, and I'm sure you'll all be hearing more about that as we move along. The department's unemployment insurance division provides needed benefits to workers who lose their jobs through no fault of their own. Our UI system was put to the test during the pandemic, and we've taken the lessons learned in that experience and are using them to develop a new and improved UI benefit system. This new system is being developed at considerably lower costs than other states are paying for their own modernization projects. The new system will go live later this year and lead to significant improvements in customer service and operational efficiencies. Our two back office divisions, centralized services and technology support, provide critical services that help the department operate with effectiveness in a way that's accountable to both lawmakers and the taxpaying public. So in conclusion, the last 2 years, we have seen significant changes at DLI. I'm pleased with our out-of-box thinking and problem-solving that this has helped us reduce overall our FTE headcount by some 40 positions. Montana has seen significant changes in its economy in the aftermath of the pandemic. And DLI and our 750 employees are committed to providing the highest level of service to Montana's workers and employers. With that, I know you guys are trying to stay on schedule, so we're happy to take any questions. My team is here. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. It's great to have you here. Members will have a lot of bills that are coming not only from the agency as part of the Red Tape Relief Task Force and other matters, but also from individual legislators that will have bills under the purview of the Department of Labor. It's a big agency for us. Are there questions for the commissioner from members of the committee? Representative Marshall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Commissioner, I'm looking in here, and this has piqued my curiosity as a business owner who's found it difficult to find employees. So on here you have listed that 2,700 continuation filing claims for UI. How many weeks can somebody in the state of Montana stay on unemployment?
26
weeks, so 8 months.
Correct.
Thank you.
Any further questions for the commissioner? Representative Galloway.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. Glancing through here, the AmeriCorps, at a glance, there's 139 service locations. Could you just give us a broad view of what those are and what we're accomplishing?
With AmeriCorps, to be honest, I cannot. Sarah Sadowski is in charge. It's a separate office that's attached to us, but I could certainly have her answer any questions you have.
Thank you.
Is Ms. Sadowski in the room?
I don't think so.
Okay. So you'll get back to us with some of that.
Thank you. We'll follow up,
Commissioner.
With that.
Any further questions for the commissioner? Representative Carter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Esau, you mentioned FTE reductions 25 and 40. Do you feel that's affected the quality of services to businesses in Montana, and how do you assess that?
The 40 includes the 25. So we have repurposed. We went through workforce services, we reorged, so we have job service that is really doing the intake of people that come in that need benefits, they need resume writing, they need just the basic instructions of how to find a job. And then we have a new group that is dealing with business and our community colleges to make sure that we're getting people the training and upskilling they need. So we came about that in terms of just this makes sense. The other 15 FTEs are reductions throughout the department. Some that haven't been filled, there will be some savings from consolidating the two agencies because they have similar tasks. And so we're not laying anybody off. These are positions we're not filling. So no, the answer is no, I don't believe so. But we'll monitor that as we move along.
Any further questions from the committee? Representative Galloway.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. In recent years, I haven't been involved in my businesses as much, but I used to try to work through the unemployment office, which is under this, and they had developed this online system. But I found it very cumbersome. Has that been improved any? And do you have any plans to possibly outreach to employers to understand how to use that system, because I think it's a great way, but it just seemed difficult to get connected up.
Yeah, so as I mentioned, we're going through a whole modernization process with our unemployment insurance, and that should be launched in October, and then we would be doing outreach with everybody. Right now, we're dealing with an outdated 20-year-old Oracle platform that is really no good for anybody, to be honest. So it can only get better. It'll just be a little bit a matter of time.
Thank you very much.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Commissioner. Great to have you here today, and appreciate you educating the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Okay, members, we're going to get into the bill hearing process. Representative Miner is here, so we will go ahead and open the hearing on House Bill 120. Representative Miner, is this your first bill?
This is my first bill.
We are honored to host your first ever bill, Representative Miner.
Thank you. Chairman Betry, members of the committee, I am Russ Miner, M-I-N-E-R, a representative for House District 19, which is rural Cascade County. I bring before you today House Bill 120, an act allowing the Department of Revenue to sponsor alcohol beverage manufacturer trade shows, allowing alcohol beverage manufacturers to showcase products at trade shows and provide rulemaking authority. HB 120 would do the following. The bill has a positive impact on alcohol beverage manufacturers because it allows them to showcase their products to industry trade show attendees, allows the Department of Revenue to sponsor industry trade shows and work through other state agencies to sponsor an industry trade show, provide direction to alcohol beverage manufacturers on how product can get to the industry trade, establish what alcohol beverage manufacturers can do at trade shows, allows the Department of Revenue to implement rules pertaining to alcohol beverage industry trade shows. This bill has been requested by the Department of Revenue. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Miner. We will start with proponents to House Bill 120. Are there proponents in the room?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Steve Swanson, S-W-A-N-S-O-N, and I'm with the Montana Department of Revenue Alcoholic Beverage Control Division. We'd first like to thank Representative Miner for sponsoring this bill. I think he did a great job framing it. As you can see, there's not much to this bill. It simply allows the department to sponsor alcoholic beverage trade shows. These trade shows are designed to give alcoholic beverage manufacturers an additional avenue to showcase and sample their products to attendees. Trade shows do occur. The Montana Tavern Association puts on a great show in September of every year for its members. And as of recently, the Department of Agriculture has held events where our alcoholic beverage manufacturers attend as well. This bill would allow us to partner with the folks at Department of Agriculture to help them with their event and ensure its success. So we appreciate your support, and I'll be available for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Swanson. Other proponents, House Bill 120.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Court Jensen, C-O-R-T-J-E-N-S-E-N. I am the chief attorney for the Montana Department of Agriculture, and we are in some ways also responsible for this bill. It's at the request of our sister agency, Department of Revenue, but while they control and regulate alcohol, we are tasked with promoting the agricultural products and derivatives of Montana. We grow some of the finest barley in the world, but rarely does it touch human lips in the form of food, but often drink. We do beverage shows and trade teams around the state, and what we have in the current regulations on alcohol without this bill is rules for trade shows involving for-profit businesses, rules for trade shows involving nonprofit businesses, but no one ever thought the government would be here to help. So as we tried to organize it, it was really a round peg in a square hole. And what we want to do is make sure that departments, as well as businesses, follow the rules and laws. And so by allowing us to partner with revenue and create rules for those trade shows, it'll make sure it's fair and equitable to the private business. But we're here to promote all of Montana's fine agricultural products, be they beer or distilled liquors, and we are tasked with it in a more clear-cut way in our marketing unit. And we just hope to continue the practice. Thank you so much for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Jensen. Other proponents? Any other proponents in the committee room?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Rhonda Wiggers, W-I-G-G-E-R-S, but I'm actually here on behalf of Jen Hensley with the Montana Distillers Guild. She had to be in another hearing upstairs and asked that I go on record that the Montana Distillers Guild appreciates this bill and is in full support. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wiggers. Any other proponents in the room? I think we may have a proponent online. Caitlin, do we have anyone online as a proponent?
Not for this bill, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. We'll go to opponents in the room. Opponents, seeing none. Opponents online, seeing none. Informational witnesses, seeing none. Questions from the committee. Representative Logie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Logie.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Swanson, it says in the bill, it says provide samples of its products to attendees, but then it also says department may adopt rules. And I was just wondering, would there be any charge for these samples? Is that into the bill that there could be charges for those samples?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Logie, I think that's something that we'll probably want to address in rule. I think getting the involvement from the industry members that are going to be involved would be important. So we had no intent of allowing samples, the charge for the samples. But like I said, I think it would be something that we would want to address via administrative rule.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Swanson.
Thank you.
Further questions from the committee? Representative Harvey, Vice Chair Harvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Also for Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Swanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Swanson. So I have a little bit of a logistic question around these trade shows. Would the distillers or different folks that are coming to this trade show to have a booth, would they pay any type of entry fee to be there?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Harvey, it's not our intent to charge attendees. We'll organize and help send out invitations and get things set up, but it's not our intent to charge distillers, brewers, or wineries admission fee to have a booth.
Okay. Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Swanson, so I guess my question now would be, if something was to happen at this event, where would the liability fall?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Harvey, great question. I think it's something that I might have to follow up on. I think the intent is to have these events at a licensed establishment or at an event catered by a licensee. So it may come back on the licensee and the liquor liability that they have.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess with that, I would just say that I think it would be good to have somewhere stating where that liability would fall, whether that's the sponsored or the venue has to have some type of liability coverage. That way we're not putting that back on the state, eventually back on the taxpayers. So.
Mr. Swanson, do you wish to respond to that?
We'll visit with our, Mr. Chairman, we'll visit with our folks and we'll see what we can do.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions from the committee? Representative Galloway.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Swanson, so does this need a fiscal note? Is there going to be cost to your department to set these up and send out the invitation, FTE time?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Galloway, I don't think so. We're not going to have a ton of these events, maybe one, two a year. There may be some costs in renting a facility or something like that, but I think it's going to be generally very minimal.
Follow-up. So you wouldn't, most of this type of events that I've attended with my business is usually the people that are showing their wares absorb those costs, but you're thinking that the department's going to?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Galloway, like I mentioned, I think it's going to be very minimal. The the small number of events that's likely to happen. Certainly, we're going to have involvement of our staff there to help set it up, but I think it's going to be minimal.
Follow-up. Mr. Chair, Mr. Swanson, so do you think we could clarify that somehow in this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Galloway, I'm open to suggestions. You know, if there's language that you would like to propose, we would certainly listen to it.
One more follow-up.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I sometimes am real nervous to leave all of this up to rules because it can get far and wide from what we felt the intention of the bill is. And so I feel like it would behoove us to have some clarification that we aren't using taxpayer dollars to fund an industry.
Thank you.
Further questions from the committee? Representative Carter.
Thank you, Chair Buttrie. This is also for Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Swanson.
Chair Buttrie, Mr. Swanson, so explain to me as a new legislator here, this seems to be out of the wheelhouse of the Department of Revenue. Does the Department of Revenue do these things for other industries and other things? It seems like, seems dysfunctional to me.
Chairman Buttrie and Representative Carter, negative. The department does not, the Alcoholic Beverage Control Division currently does not do these. The Alcoholic Beverage Code, you know, unless it explicitly allows for something, it's generally prohibited. So for transparency, we wanted to get it in statute so that all of our industry members know that it's happening. And obviously, there's going to be a great involvement with them being participants at the trade shows.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
Mr. Chair, why not leave this to the industry representatives and those folks to do this as opposed to putting it onto the state and having the state do this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carter, that's a great question. You know, generally there hasn't been a lot of trade shows. Like I mentioned, the Tavern Association has a trade show in the fall of every year. Participation is probably limited in some aspects. You know, there's avenues where liquor store agents and off-prem locations can they could attend the MTA and join, but they don't necessarily have there isn't necessarily another trade show where they can attend without the manufacturer specifically going to their establishment. And in those cases, those licensees can't allow on-premise consumption, so they wouldn't even be able to sample the product at the premises. So this gives an avenue for all licensees and agency liquor stores, and you know, an opportunity to attend another trade show and see those products firsthand.
Understood. A new question, Mr. Chair.
New question for
Mr. Swanson also.
Okay, follow up.
Mr. Swanson, now this is specifically for the manufacturers. Why not allow distributors and everybody else in on this as well?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carter, another great question. Typically, you know, if you want to make an amendment to allow wholesalers and distributors to participate, you know, I think we would be welcome to that. They certainly know the alcoholic beverage products that they're distributing, so it certainly makes sense that they could be part of this as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Mr. Swanson.
Thank you. Any further questions from the committee? Seeing none, Representative Miner, would you care to close on your bill?
HD 120 would particularly benefit small alcohol beverage manufacturers. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Miner. This will close the hearing on House Bill 120. Okay, we're waiting for our next bill sponsor, so we'll stand at ease for just a few minutes.
Be right back.
If we could ask the committee room to please come back to order. Members take their seats. We're going to open the bill hearing on House Bill 30. Representative Buckley.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, good members of the committee. For the record, my name is Representative Alice Buckley. I am here today out of House District 63, and I am presenting House Bill 30. House Bill 30 is brought to you by the Montana Division of Banking. The intention of the bill is to address several changes in the mortgage industry, which have necessitated a need to modify some of Montana's mortgage laws. There's a lot in front of you. I hope we can make this as simple as possible. So I'll give you the highlights of the changes, and then the much smarter folks at the from the Division of Banking can walk you through it in a bit more detail. They can answer all of your questions as well. The main provisions of this bill allow the Division of Banking to adopt prudential or financial standards for large non-depository mortgage servicers. Mortgage servicers are entities that accept mortgage payments from borrowers, and they pay those taxes and the insurance owed and forward the rest of the payment to the mortgage holder. So the intention of this bill is to hold those entities responsible to the financial standards and allow them to meet their ongoing obligations to borrowers and lenders. The bill allows the Commissioner of Banking to order an entity to comply with the prudential standards if circumstances dictate, or it allows the Commissioner to exempt an entity from the standards as needed as well. So again, it's giving the Commissioner of Banking the statutory authority to order a mortgage servicer to comply with those standards. In addition, the bill adds reverse mortgage providers to the definitions. There's quite a long definition section there that you'll see, and it excludes nonprofit lenders from servicing requirements on the loans they make as well. A couple more sections for you. Section 7 ensures code is up to date with changing times. It allows individuals in the mortgage industry to work remotely under certain conditions. We had to think about this during the pandemic, of course. And if they're doing so, it just puts some guardrails on there and just ensures that confidential borrower information is handled properly and is not subject to misuse. It also reduces the regulatory burden by allowing a single designated manager to supervise multiple remote workers. In Section 13, the bill defines confidential supervisory information so that the term confidential information is used in statute but has not been defined, so we're just defining that. And then Section 14 adds a requirement that these entities report a cybersecurity incident to the division within 15 days. Finally, Section 12 removes the examination fee for licensees but leaves the authority for the division to charge unlicensed persons or entities for examinations. I'll pause there. Thank you all for bearing with me. Thanks for the opportunity to present this bill on the behalf of the Division of Banking. Really pleased to do it, and I just ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Buckley. We'll start with proponents to House Bill 30 in the room. Commissioner Hall.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Melanie Hall, Commissioner of the Division of Banking and Financial Institutions, which, as I stated earlier, is part of the Department of Administration. As indicated in Representative Buckley's remarks, the primary purpose of HB 30 is to adopt prudential or financial standards for mortgage servicers and to modernize a number of other provisions in the Mortgage Act. I'm going to begin by discussing, instead of stepping through one by one, to discuss the substantive changes to the bill, and then we'll address those that fall more into the category of housekeeping. But the division has prepared a section-by-section analysis that, because I know what we do is a little weedy, that may be helpful to you as you consider the bill. Mr. Chair, can I distribute?
Please.
Thank you. There are 21, so there should be enough for staff and the committee. The substantive changes to the bill begin with new sections 1-5. These are the prudential standards for mortgage servicers and a definition section, which is specific to the new sections on mortgage servicers and prudential standards. As stated earlier, mortgage servicers are entities that receive mortgage payments from a borrower and then pay the taxes, the insurance, and then send the remainder of the payment to the mortgage holder or the lender. Mortgage servicers are licensed and regulated by the Banking Division, and they have been since 2011. The new sections of this bill require servicers to maintain capital, so equity and liquidity standards, and corporate governance standards as set forth by the department in rule. The bill allows the division to adopt the model state regulatory prudential standards for non-bank mortgage servicers. These are standards that were adopted by the Conference of State Bank Supervisors, which is my like regulatory professional association. So all the states have agreed to these standards. The standards themselves were adopted in consultation and agreement with state regulators, non-depository mortgage servicers, and market participants to make sure that this was fair to everyone and provided a more stable mortgage market. The model standards are nationwide standards, and they, as they are adopted across the states, will bring consistency to the mortgage market. In light of current events involving some financial services companies, I don't need to tell you how important it is to have strong corporate governance requirements as well as liquidity and capital standards for entities that handle consumer and customer funds. Additionally, new Section 6 allows mortgage business to be conducted remotely. Much of the mortgage industry went remote during the pandemic, as did almost everything else. Since that time, mortgage companies have consistently told states that they would like the ability for their employees to continue to work remotely. This bill allows mortgage personnel to work remotely while still ensuring that customer information is kept secure and confidential. It allows the banking division to examine these entities and ensure that mortgage entities are maintaining adequate supervision and control over these remote employees and agents. It also amends the designated manager requirements to allow a designated manager to supervise more than one location and to supervise remote employees. Designated managers are typically loan originators who have more experience. They have to meet certain standards for experience and education. And previously, we required there to be one designated manager at anywhere there were loans being made, but now that loans are made in people's homes, this will allow one person to be in charge of a number of people who are working remotely. New Section 8 adds reverse mortgages to the definition of servicers. It requires reverse mortgage entities to be licensed and regulated the same as forward mortgage servicers. Reverse mortgages can be a useful but also challenging product, and so it is important that there be substantial and meaningful oversight of these entities that deal primarily with seniors. So new Section 9 allows bona fide not-for-profit entities an exemption to act as mortgage servicers. This exemption was specifically requested by Habitat for Humanity so that they can continue to work with individuals who are in the process of building and financing a home. New Section 12 removes the ability of the banking division to charge licensees for examinations. Licensees pay license fees that are sufficient to cover the cost of examinations. And so we are getting rid of the individual exam fees. They pay licensing fees based on the number of individuals they have that work for their company, and our fees are substantial, and so that's enough. It retains the ability of the banking division, however, to charge unlicensed persons or entities for exams. So if we hear of someone who is engaged in unlicensed activity, we could still go in and examine that entity to see what they're doing and charge them for that exam. New Section 13 clarifies that confidential information is confidential supervisory information and defines that term. This definition is consistent with the definition used in federal law. And new Section 14 requires mortgage entities to report any cybersecurity incident within 15 business days after the licensee has reason to know of the event. Currently, there is a requirement that the Attorney General's office be notified if there is a cybersecurity event. This does not change that requirement. It adds to it so that the banking division, who actually licenses and regulates these entities, will also be made aware if there is a cybersecurity event. And I think that's it. I know that this is a pretty thick bill for the third day of session, but I thank you so much for your consideration, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you have. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner Hall. Are there other proponents for House Bill 30?
Chair Butchie, members of the committee, my name is Ron Culver. I'm the real estate market manager for Stockman Bank out of Bozeman and the president of the Montana Association for Mortgage Professionals.
Can you spell your last name, please?
C-U-L-V as in Victor, E-R. House Bill 30 does not impact mortgage professionals like me who work at a regulated depository institution. I'm here today to support HB 30 on behalf of the Montana Association for Mortgage Professionals and its membership. Changes in technology have advanced the ability of all of us to work remotely and have also changed the mortgage industry quite a bit. Allowing individuals to originate mortgages remotely has been done successfully under emergency orders in other states and pursuant to rules in other states in the past few years. I've been involved in similar legislation in the state of Washington, and I know that many other states are permitting remote work. This bill is consistent with what those states are doing to allow for remote work while ensuring that customer information is kept secure. Additionally, the language concerning the prudential standards for mortgage servicers is uniform language that the mortgage industry and state regulators have negotiated to ensure that mortgage servicers can financially withstand economic and business cycle ups and downs, which we're obviously aware of currently. Mortgage servicing entities such as Rocket Mortgage have reached out to me to ask me to testify in support of this legislation in order to ensure consistent standards across all states. I ask for your support of HB 30 and I'm available for any questions from the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Colbert. Are there other proponents for House Bill 30?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Kerry Hegreberg. It's H-E-G-R-E-B-E-R-G. I'm the president and CEO of the Montana Bankers Association. We'd like to thank the commissioner and the division for working with us throughout the duration of all the bills that they're bringing forward that relate to banking and financial institutions in Montana. We think this bill levels the playing field, you know, for traditional banks. Protects consumers and basically unifies or makes a more uniform lending scenario throughout the country. So just wanted to let you know that the commissioner and her office have worked with us throughout the duration of the drafting of this bill, and we are in support. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hegreberg. Other proponents in the room? House Bill 30? Other proponents? Seeing none. Are there any hands raised online? Seeing none, we'll go to opponents. Opponents, House Bill 30. Seeing none present, none online. Informational witnesses. Any informational witnesses? Seeing none. Questions from the committee. Representative Oblander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question would be for Commissioner Hall.
Commissioner Hall.
Good morning.
Mr. Chair, Representative Oblander.
In the new Section 5, you're discussing risk. And if risk is determined by a formal review and so forth, that you can make determinations on if they are high risk or low risk. What are your parameters for determining if somebody is high or low risk?
Mr. Chair, Representative Oblender, the division regularly examines these entities, and actually to brag on one of my people who's here today, Chris Romano, recently led the multi-state exam of the largest loan originator who has lots of Super Bowl ads, and the origination and servicing exam of that entity with 37 states participating with over 100 examiners on site and remote. And so we have standards in terms of looking at what their earnings are quarter by quarter, and we are reviewing this regularly, what their equity position is. We look at what their operating capital is and what their operating expenses are in order to, because some of these entities actually operate, and this has been a concern for some time, with incredibly low operating capital. And so in a downturn like we're currently experiencing in the mortgage market, where you have a significant downturn in earnings stream, we want to make sure that these entities are holding enough capital to get through that business cycle so that they are not having to take borrower payments for today to apply to last month, to apply and then take next month's, and we all know how that goes because eventually that stops. And so we monitor on a regular basis their operating capital, their operating expenses, and we look at those ratios to make sure. So for instance, at a traditional bank, as Mr. Hegerberg said, they hold equity capital of anywhere from 8% for our larger banks in Montana to I mean, some have like 17%, which is very high. But typically, we're looking for them to hold 10 to 12% in equity capital. Some of these entities operate at 3%. So look at those kind of financial factors in order to determine high risk versus low risk. I hope that answers your question. If not,
follow up.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, so if somebody is a high risk, there are certain things that you will go out and then require that they do. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Oblander, yes, that is correct. The division has taken enforcement action in the past due to low liquidity and low capital levels with other states, but we do not have specific standards for that. We just had to say you don't have enough, and we would like to be able to provide better guidance in terms of what is enough.
One more follow-up.
Follow-up.
Mr. Chair. Commissioner, so is that a negotiated thing between you and the mortgage company?
Mr. Chair, Representative Oblander, hopefully it is negotiated and done in coordination with them, and we enter into an agreement about that. If we cannot reach an agreement, then we can bring a cease and desist action that requires them to reach certain capital levels or liquidity levels within a certain time frame, and that is less negotiated.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Any other questions? Representative Galloway.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a couple for Ms. Hall.
Ms. Hall.
Could you elaborate a little bit on remote versus present? Because in the present, you've had to have somebody who's, I understand, licensed on premise. So how is that overseen now when you have somebody that's remote? And
Mr. Chair, Representative Galloway, anyone who is originating a mortgage loan, which is defined as you are discussing terms or anything like that, has to be licensed. What we are going to allow is for a designated manager, which is someone who has more experience. We previously required that person with more experience, so say that was, say I'm the person with more experience designated manager and you are the new loan originator, that we had to sit in the same office space. And I could only manage people that were in that same office space. So if you were,
Representative Galloway,
Great Falls. So if you were in Great Falls and Representative Sullivan was in Billings, I could not manage both of you because you were in different places. Now I, in Helena, could be your designated manager in Great Falls and Representative Sullivan's designated manager in Billings from Helena. And so I would just have to do sort of general remote management in the same way that all businesses have to do remote management. And most of these companies have pretty sophisticated software systems that allow for the transmittal of information around loans that you're originating.
So follow up. Mr. Chair, so what you're saying then is that person's going to be remotely reviewing what they're doing because they're the one that's licensed, not...
Mr. Chair, Representative Galloway, they'll all be licensed as loan originators, and they have a little number, an NMLS number that each person has, and it has to be on any document that they do with any consumer, a little NMLS ID. It will simply allow somebody who has more experience to manage each licensee. So the manager is licensed, but all of the other people are licensed as well and have continuing education requirements on an annual basis.
Okay. Another question, Mr. Chair.
For Ms. Hall?
Yes, please.
Follow up.
On a different subject, you touched on the nonprofit versus for-profit. Can you explain how, if we have a section that's in there for nonprofit, that it's not adversarial towards the profit side?
Chair Buttrey, Representative Galloway, I will do my best and look back at my team. If there's somebody you want to jump up or you want me to try. I'll try.
I don't mean to be difficult. I just like to understand.
Representative Galloway, not at all. I'm just not sure I'm the best person to answer. But this was requested specifically by Habitat for Humanity, who may or may not have the same kind of capital and equity that other large servicers would have. So they don't, they help individuals, you know, build a home and then make payments, but Habitat for Humanity doesn't, the specific things that they're asking to be exempt from concern capital and liquidity requirements, which could be challenging for a nonprofit versus a for-profit to maintain. They just aren't gonna hold so much equity.
Follow up. On that same parameter, we've seen that be a deficiency to the small home builder in their other entities because they have an advantage, and it basically put most people that built spec houses out of that market, and I wouldn't want to see similar effects to the commercial side of this, so I just, that's where my concern lies, so.
Mr. Chair, Representative Galloway, I could also follow up with you about that. Thank you.
Another follow-up?
Follow-up.
So on the cybersecurity, my concern was is that it says 15 days. If they know this, why not require it to be immediately reported and no longer than, I think, a lot shorter? Because a lot of damage can be done to somebody's private information over a 15-day period.
Mr. Chair, Representative Galloway, I would love for it to be immediate, but I think 15 days has kind of been a general sort of accepted amount of time, and I think it's consistent with what is required currently in state law for reporting to the Attorney General's office. It's a 15-day requirement to them, so we were just trying to be consistent.
All right, thank you.
Representative Gist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a little bit side note on Habitat for Humanity. The Great Falls Habitat for Humanity has only built like 40-some houses, low 40s, over the number of years they've done it to Flathead. I think they're in the mid-70s in all the years they've done it. So as far as affecting the other markets, I don't think they're a big piece in that, but they are a very important piece to low income, and they do an awesome job. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gist. Representative Zolnikoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for Commissioner Hall, please.
Commissioner Hall.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Hall, I'm looking at Section 7 on page 6, letter G. It says, the licensed mortgage entities, employees, and independent contractors take reasonable precautions to protect confidential information. I was wondering if reasonable precautions is designed statutorily somewhere, or if that would fall under the department's rulemaking.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zolnikoff, it would fall under the department's rulemaking, and generally what we require is that they have a information technology plan that is like a structure and entire process. And so for a large, but we do try to be very cautious around these servicers to make sure that what we're requiring is consistent with the size of the entity. So we would expect a small Montana-based mortgage servicer to have a cybersecurity framework that includes patching, multi-factor authentication, those sorts of things. We would expect a large nationwide servicer that services millions of mortgages to have a much more sophisticated IT framework. And so we will set forth those requirements in rule, and we may already have them. No, not yet.
Thank you.
Further questions from the committee? Representative Carter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for Commissioner Hall.
Commissioner Hall.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Hall, in new section 7, page 5, letter B, no physical or electronic business records are maintained at the remote location. As a frequent remote worker and having remote employees, I take maintained as they're not changed. I wonder if a better word for that is not stored at a remote location as opposed to maintained, because if a remote employee is updating lender information or lendee information or their own payroll information, they're actually maintaining those records. And I wonder if what is intended there is stored at the remote location.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carter, as a technology person, you will understand these terms better than I will. What I would say is the point of this is that any and all records that contain consumer information should be stored on the company's cloud and not on local devices. And so if you believe the word stored is better than maintained, we would be open to the amendment. Our point on this is that things should not be stored on local maintained on local devices. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Ms. Commissioner Hall.
Further questions from the committee? Further questions? Seeing none. Representative Buckley, would you care to close in your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee, for a good hearing. Thank you for all your questions. I felt really impressed when Commissioner Hall came in front of the Economic Affairs Interim Committee. It feels like such a good example of the kind of bills we are trying to pass to support our agencies and departments in doing good work as efficiently and as effectively as possible. So I would urge you to pass, and thank you for your attention today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. We'll close the hearing on House Bill 30. Members, just a couple housekeeping items before we move forward. There is a fiscal note to House Bill 30. It's got a good explanation on it. If there's questions on that fiscal note, we can address it in executive action. Just a couple comments on the hearing. We did have the names of companies that were spoken during the hearing. Typically, I won't allow that. One of those companies that was mentioned was actually making requests for certain changes to the bill, so we'll let that go. I saw Commissioner Hall kind of fixed it at the end where she talked about a company that was on the Super Bowl ads versus naming the company. We don't tend to use companies' proper names. Also, we did allow a little bit of commentary during the questioning period. Just keep in mind, most of that period is for questions, not to make comments. Most comments are best suited for executive action, but we won't be too harsh on anything. If you feel like you need to say something, go ahead and say it. Thank you, members. Next bill, do we have Representative Bergstrom ready?
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Quick question. Are we going to be using the whiteboard behind you to list bills?
We are. Thank you, Representative Gunderson. Starting tomorrow, the whiteboard to this side, it switched sides on us, will have the bills listed in the order of bills, the order they'll be heard in, and that will start tomorrow.
And one other thing, Mr. Chair, is, sure. As we're seeing more agencies come to us, is there any way to have staff come up with a spreadsheet of contact information to where we know who's who and how to contact them, as well as the lobbyists?
Thank you, Representative. We'll refer that to Jameson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe I made one last year, and most of the contacts are up to date, so I will certainly retrieve that from my computer, Madam Chair. Or Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Jameson. Okay, with that, we will open the hearing on House Bill 41. Representative Bergstrom.
Okay. Chairman Buttrey and council members, my name is James Bergstrom. I represent House District Number 30. And I'm here to present House Bill Number 41. This is a bill that I was asked to carry by the Department of Labor and Industry. The bill allows all Montana employers to apply for the incumbent worker training grant program and increases the grant amount from $2,000 to $3,000 per worker. Currently, the incumbent worker training program awards grants to Montana small businesses to offset for worker training up to $2,000 per employee. The training must increase the worker skill level, result in a wage gain, or expand business revenue. Over the last 5 years, 640 businesses have received grants totaling $1.5 million in training over 2,000 employees. These businesses are in more than 30 counties and in nearly every industry. The incumbent worker training program trains or worker training grants have helped these businesses expand and pass their success onto workers in terms of higher wages. One example is Big Sky Adventure and Tours reported a 20% increase in revenues and a $3 per hour wage increase for tour guides due to the program. Other success stories are mentioned in the handout that you were just given. The incumbent worker training grants can be used for a short-term training for a new task or in a new way of performing an old task. Could include certifications or a non-degree post-secondary course or improve soft skills. The grants are not intended to be used to train a worker up to minimum standards for an occupation. Continuing education required for professional license is not eligible for training, nor are conferences, subscriptions, or memberships to professional organizations. House Bill 41 would increase the per worker grant amount from $2,000 to $3,000 and expand the program to Montana employers of all sizes with the intent of fully exhausting the allocated funds. The appropriation for this program is $540,000 through the Employment Security Account funds. And that's an amount per year. But this funding has not been fully utilized. In your handout, you'll see that utilization of the funds over the last five fiscal years, during this time, only 54% of the allotted funds have been awarded. I'd encourage you to pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bergstrom. We will start with proponents to House Bill 41.
Mr. Chair, my name is Barb Wagner, W-I-G-N-E-R, and I am the Interim Division Administrator for the Workforce Services Division at the Montana Department of Labor and Industry. And on behalf of the department and the administration, I encourage you to support House Bill 41. Representative Bergstrom did a great job describing the bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions about the incumbent worker training program. The bill has three sections. The first section increases the cap on the size of businesses, allowing all Montana businesses to apply for the grant program. The second section of the bill is actually a cleanup. It doesn't really do anything. It does remove the definition of employee from that section of bill. We don't use that definition of employee at all. We use the definition of worker. So it removes that and just does the cleanup while we're considering this section of the code. Our chief legal for the department, Quinlan O'Connor, is here to answer any questions about that cleanup section. And then the last section, I call it an inflation adjustment, although it probably is a little, it just moves the per worker grant amount from $2,000 up to $3,000. This program is a pretty good program. You have your handout. There's a large description and several different success stories. We also have a data dashboard available that's listed on the back of the handout if you have any further questions. Thank you for your time. I encourage it to pass.
Thank you, Ms. Wagner. Other proponents?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Brad Griffin. I'm here today on behalf of all the organizations that I represent, the retailers, the restaurant operators, equipment dealers, and chiropractors. And we rise in support of the bill. It's workforce training is something that we do spend a lot of money on, and if we can get some assistance with being reimbursed for that, that certainly helps. So we appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Griffin. Other proponents?
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Smith, and I'm the executive director of the Montana Contractors Association. The MCA represents heavy highway, civil, and commercial construction members of our state. We rise in support of this. I also, in a different role, serve on the State Workforce Investment Board, so I'm not representing them with any of these comments either, but I will tell you that that's been a common thread on the SWIB, is how do we improve wages and worker training along the way. But these are comments from the Montana Contractors Association. I can think of, off the top of my head, three companies that are very substantial companies in the state of Montana involved in the role of construction. All of these have over 50 employees. All of these are very extensively involved in training their employees through their own apprenticeship programs that they've developed, as well as through upper-level management type of training that they send their people to constantly. And in the construction world, training is all we do from November to about March, or whenever the frost leaves the ground. So training is very important, and that is everything from safety to supervisory training. Some of these companies that I'm going to not mention are involved in plumbing and heating. They're involved in large-scale commercial construction, and they are involved in highway construction, too. One of the highway construction companies that I'm thinking of also has operations in Oregon. Oregon has a very similar program, almost identical to what you're considering. And when they tried to use this same source of funding here in Montana, they were not able because they have more than 50 employees. So trying to get good people hired up at good wages and advancing their careers, that's what we're all about here. One last thing I just thought about on this, why has it only been about 50% of it used over the last five fiscal years is probably a question you're going to ask. I would just say that we haven't had the dire straits of training and retaining employees like we do right now for the last several years. So, Mr. Chair, thank you. I'll be ready for comment or questions if you have them. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Other proponents?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Charles Robison, that's R-O-B-I-S-O-N, here on behalf of the Montana Chamber of Commerce. And workforce development, training, upskilling is very important to all companies in Montana of all sizes, and we support the department's proposed change to get these funds out there, put them to work, and get more people trained up. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Robison. Any other proponents in the room?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Rebecca Myers, M-E-Y-E-R-S. I'm here today on behalf of MEDA, the Montana Economic Developers Association, and we are in support of House Bill 41. I'd like to thank the sponsor and the department for their work on this. Economic developers throughout the state have seen the incumbent worker training program have a really positive impact on businesses across many spheres of professions and across the state. You've heard a lot of examples of success stories. I won't get into those details, just for your time. If you want more, I've got plenty that I can send to the committee. We've seen a lot of training dollars that are no longer going far enough between the rising costs of training and then the travel associated with that training. We would be very supportive of the dollars increasing from $2,000 to $3,000 and believe that this program is critical to the continued positive impact on the workforce and employees across the state. I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Myers. Other proponents?
Chair Budgery and members of the committee, for the record, Webb Brown, Montana Dental Association. Rise in support of the bill today and appreciation to Representative Bergstrom bringing this forward. With my 1 year in the job with the Dental Association, I've realized that my dentists are not taking advantage of this program, and yet there are significant training needs that are out there. So I've talked with Sarah Swanson, the governor's office. We actually have an article in our newsletter that just came out telling our folks about the opportunity here. This would be an expansion of that, an opportunity to do even more. And I'll give you a good example of that. We are now before the Montana Board of Dentistry, talking about a radiology program for dental assistants that would allow them to take x-rays in the state. And again, I think a perfect example of how these funds could be used to increase the marketability of employees and help their take-home pay overall. So we would support this bill and urge your due pass. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Any other proponents in the room? Seeing none, we'll go to online proponents. Looks like we've got Mr. Gilbertson with his hand up.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Chair. Adam Gilbertson, G-I-L-B-E-R-T-S-O-N, former president of the Montana Equipment Dealers Association and vice president of RDO Equipment Company with six locations in Montana. I'm in Laurel, where I reside. We're rising in support of this bill, and I thought I'd maybe just add some color context of how it looks for a business that is currently affected by this. As a company, we have 160 employees in the state today, so we are ineligible for the program. But in the six locations where we have businesses across the state, we have none of those locations are over that 50 employee threshold. And so as we think about how we might be able to invest in a program like this and work through the incumbent worker side of things, this may give us an opportunity to open the scope of talent that we consider and help companies like us in our industry bring on someone who may be not quite as skilled and move them through this program with an investment through the incumbent worker program and help to grow those skills in the business. And so I would really appreciate your positive vote on this bill, and we rise in support of it.
Thank you, Mr. Gilbertson. Are there other proponents online? Ms. Boatman.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Linda Boatman, spelled B as in boat, O-A-T-M-A-N. I'm the Director of Human Resources for Torgerson's, and I'm here to speak today on behalf of House Bill 41. We are a Montana-based privately owned family dealership, started in 1912 in Etheridge, Montana, and provide agricultural, construction, rental and forestry equipment sales, parts and service, as well as agronomy services to our Montana producers. And we have 12 branches throughout Montana and provide support to our rural communities. This bill, in increasing the number of employees that a company can have to take advantage of this amount that could be reimbursed to us, would be instrumental in us continuing to support this education that we spend a lot of money on, hundreds and thousands of dollars of our own pocket money in scholarships and training and internships to keep our Montana kids here in Montana and learning and helping them to develop to becoming professionals. So we thank you for allowing us to speak today, and we give support to this bill, and thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Boatman. If we can make sure to have Ms. Boatman and Mr. Gilbertson stay online in case there's questions from the committee. Are there any other proponents? Seeing none. Are there opponents? Opponents to House Bill 41. Any opponents? Seeing none. Informational witnesses? Seeing none. Questions from the committee. Representative Logie.
Mr. Chair, for Ms. Wagner.
Ms. Wagner.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Wagner, would you see any problem if this bill were amended and said upon passage?
Mr. Chair, do I see any problems?
Yeah, if we amended it to say upon passage so that it took effect immediately if we're looking for jobs.
Mr. Chair, I believe that we would want to do some rulemaking. Just going to have our chief legal come up here and answer that question.
Refer
us.
Representative Logie.
Yes, please.
Please give your name for the record.
Chair Buttry, my name is Quinlan O'Connor. I'm chief legal counsel for the Department of Labor and Industry. Representative Logie, yes, there's rulemaking associated with the IWT program. We typically update that on an annual basis. And with the fiscal year, because that's the timing that resets the grant allocations that we're able to give and what we target. So we spend from July 1 through June 30th of the following year. I suspect if we set we could probably get that rulemaking done very quickly in line with the new fiscal year so that we could complete the grants that have already come in and started on July 1 and get rulemaking done by that time. And so I would suggest a July 1 effective date, so pretty close, rather than the October 1 default, if the committee were interested in that. And I think I could work with Barb staff on getting rulemaking done quickly so that we could effectuate any changes that needed to be made.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. O'Connell.
Representative Gist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for Ms. Wagner.
Ms. Wagner.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Wagner. Since this is designed for a small business, on page 2, that top line, employer meaning a business entity that employs striking 50 or fewer employees, because its initial design was for small business, could it put, and only half of this is being utilized, we want to see the whole grant program utilized, would it be maybe a preference given to those under 50 open, if there's no more grants applied for, that it opens it up over and above the 50 threshold?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's an interesting idea. I had not considered it before, but that is something that we probably could implement in our rulemaking to give, you know, preference points in the grant awards to smaller businesses. I think that would be something that my staff would be interested in considering. And Mr. Chair, just to follow up on one of Representative Logie's questions, we are expecting that the full grant amount is expended this year. I think part of that is we just had a few applications that had a large request, and we've worked with some manufacturers to fully exhaust the funding this year. So I do think that for this fiscal year, we will be fully exhausting the funds. This bill will help us make sure that happens in future fiscal years, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Chair.
Other questions from the committee? Representative Marshall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll start with Ms. Wagner, please.
Ms. Wagner.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Wagner, a couple of questions. This is grant money that's coming out of the budget for BNI. Right,
LNI. Mr. Chair, this funding comes through, is allocated from the employment security account funding. So what that funding is when employers pay their unemployment insurance taxes, they pay, I believe it's a 1.75% tax in addition to their unemployment taxes that goes into funding the employment security account. And that is something, that tax is something that our Montana employers have always really supported, because it funds re-employing workers more quickly in order to reduce the level of unemployment claims and get people re-employed more quickly. You asked earlier about the 26 weeks. We do our very best to make sure that they do not hit that 26 weeks and that they're re-employed quickly. And most of our UI claimants, it's about 12-week average. So we do get them re-employed more quickly. And that funding is directed towards that. So within that employment security account, we have this amount, which is involved in helping businesses become more profitable through the training of incumbent workers. I hope that answered your question, Representative.
Well, it gives me a lot more ammunition. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Wagner. So the funding actually comes from a tax all employers pay, such as myself and a few of us on this committee who are business owners. Why would it not then be, as Representative Gist said earlier, why wouldn't this program be open to all small business owners?
Mr. Chair, Representative, this is currently open to all small business owners with 50 or less, and this bill, House Bill 41, will open it to all Montana businesses, including those with 50 or more.
Okay, follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
One more question, maybe. Mr. Chair, Ms. Wagner, Section 2 down here, it has the eligible training provider. On subsection on line E down there, line 26, what is an approved entity for workforce training other than a college?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a great question. We have a lot of private providers of training in the state of Montana, and that varies. You know, a lot of them provide training for specific industries. I suppose that we could probably have some of the business proponents kind of give more examples to you of what they might. But cosmetology schools are ones that we often fund, and, you know, sending people to a private provider like a union training for electricians or plumbers, or a lot of our leadership training is through a private provider. So we maintain what is called an eligible training provider list. That's something we do on the federal level. We basically, you know, they apply to us and we make sure that they're accredited and that they are meeting all of the requirements federally that are required to make sure that that training is a legitimate training and not, you know, just fraudulent in any way. So that's a protection to the worker and the employer so that they're not sending funds to something that's fraudulent.
Okay. Great.
Thank Mr. you. Chair.
Further questions from the committee? Representative Bob Lander.
Yes, Mr. Chair, this question is for Ms. Wagner as well.
Ms. Wagner.
Thank you. Kind of a follow-up question to what Representative Gist asked. So my concern is if we open this up to all the companies in the state, which I think we should do, are the bigger companies better able to jump on this and basically get all of the funds tied up before the smaller businesses can? That would be my concern. So I don't know if there's some type, maybe you can answer this, maybe you can, if there would be a percentage type thing to make sure both sides are protected.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is something that we have talked about internally to the department. What we currently do is that we allocate a quarter of the funds each quarter, so we're not giving one employer all of the money and that employers who come to us in the next quarter still have a chance to get the grant. So we kind of allocate by quarter, and that kind of slows the funding, so it's always available to all of the new grantees. And then if someone applied last quarter and didn't receive the funding, they're still eligible for the next quarter of funds. So that's kind of our current process to make sure that the funding doesn't go just to one employer. We like to spread the wealth in that way. But there, I do think that we have talked about ways in the rulemaking process to make sure that we are not allocating funding just to one employer or just to two employers and that it's available for a wide variety of businesses. I'm interested in the ideas the Representative Gist said to target the funds and award more preference points, and that's something that the department would be interested in continuing. That would probably be done in a rulemaking process, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Any further questions from the committee? I've got a couple for Ms. Wagner. Ms. Wagner, we've had a lot of discussion, as you just brought forth, on giving preference to small business. We've heard you talk about doing it through rural. Are you open to that being done statutorily, where there, you would have a requirement to give that type of preference?
Mr. Chair, just checking with our chief legal on that question, but I'm pretty sure the department would be happy to do that. It is one of the concerns that our internal staff brought up, and it's something we've talked about a lot. And I think our chief legal would be happy to suggest some language on that.
Thank you. We'd appreciate that. Another question. Seeing the fiscal note, you've got zeros across the board. We're raising money through the unemployment insurance tax into the employment security account. And it's zero because we're anticipating that we'll go up to the limit that right now, the $540,000. My question is if we continue to grow Montana businesses and more businesses are using the unemployment insurance, is that $540,000 a cap, or will that number rise as we create more jobs?
That's an excellent question, Mr. Chair. At this point in time, the 540 would not increase. It may be in future sessions that we would want the Appropriations Committee to adjust that. That being said, we do use this ESA money for a lot of other things, and right now I'm funding a new computer system for WSD. So, you know, there's always priorities on that. So it does not automatically adjust. In terms of our FTE, we believe that our current staffing will be able to handle any additional applications. We have our staffing level, assuming that we're going to allocate the full amount of funding. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, and so while the ESA may grow, the money that will come into the incumbent worker training account will be capped at where it currently exists.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that is, of course, a legislative decision.
Okay, thank you. Representative Gist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Your questions actually sparked some other questions in my mind. So, for Ms. Wagner, how is it handled then? We had an individual online brought up that they have multiple sites. What about an individual that has multiple companies? That could throw another question into this. A parent company and then all the sub companies underneath. So you have a parent company and then they've got three or four sub companies that do fall under that 50 employee mark. Just wondering, has that ever been a concern? Or I'm just trying to formulate this in my mind. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, that's an interesting question. I don't think that that has ever been a consideration, but we consider the company to be what they report to unemployment insurance. For purposes, we keep that consistent within the department. So if they're considered different companies through unemployment insurance and have different unemployment insurance accounts, which a lot of conglomerates do have, keep those separate, we would just be considering them as separate businesses. To my knowledge, that has not necessarily occurred in the past, though. I would have to check on that.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in definitions, could that be maybe defined in definitions, between parent company, sub companies, perhaps for more clarity?
Mr. Chair, I'll refer that to our chief legal.
Mr. O'Connell.
Chair Buttrey, thank you. In short, there is a definition of employer in there already, which is left unchanged, and it's an entity that is registered with the Secretary of State if required to do so. So that's a registered sole pro, LLC, LLP, whatever entity form they may take. And so I think that there's a sufficient definition in there, unless the goal is to exclude that category of employer. The statute wouldn't permit that, particularly with the amendment. It would be any entity type that is registered. And then, as Ms. Wagner said, registered with UI is a way that we cross-reference that, and that's a way that we determine that status.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions from the committee? Seeing none. Representative Bergstrom, would you? Oh, we have one. Representative Carter.
Thank you, sir. Chair, I wasn't quick enough. Administrator Wagner also.
Ms. Wagner.
Mr. Chair,
Administrator Wagner. I like the idea of your quarterly allocation so that I'll just leave it there. How about Representative Gist's point system? Is there an option to allow preference to smaller businesses so that smaller businesses have a better chance to get in on that and have preference over larger businesses?
Mr. Chair, yes, I believe that that is something that we could consider as part of the administrative rules, and we would want to kind of come up with a fair system so that all employers know what that system is. But we're happy to have further discussion about what that looks like with those who are interested, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? Seeing none, Representative Bergstrom, would you like to close on your bill?
Chairman Buttrey and members of the committee, I want to thank you for your time and your questions and your interest in this bill and ask you to support it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. This will close the hearing on House Bill 41. Up next will be House Bill 67 as soon as Representative Nickel is ready. Will the committee room please come to order? We will now open the hearing on House Bill 67. Welcome, Representative Nickel, and welcome to your family.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I introduce House Bill 67. It's an act repealing the termination date pertaining to certain registry fees for real estate appraisers, repealing Section 12, Chapter 55. I am carrying this on behalf of the Department of Labor and Industry. Removal of a sunset date to make authority, it's to remove a sunset date to make authority permanent. It's from Title 10, 11, or, sorry, in Title 11 of the Financial Institutions Reform, Recovery, and Enforcement Act of 1889, enacted a requirement in 2017 to collect the National Registry fee from appraisers and appraisal management companies. The department collects the fees through the licensing process and passes the funds to the appraisal subcommittee of the Federal Financial Institutions Examination Council. If states do not comply, appraisers would not be allowed to perform appraisals for federally related transactions. We expect the requirements to remain and are asking for the removal of the sunset date so we can continue providing the service for appraisers and appraisal companies. And with that, I will turn it over.
Thank you, Representative Nickel. Are there proponents to House Bill 67?
Chairman Buttrey, members of the committee, my name is Eric Strauss. That's S-T-R-A-U-S-S, and I'm the administrator for the Employment Standards Division in the Montana Department of Labor and Industry. First off, let me thank Representative Nickel for carrying this on our behalf. And secondly, I think I'm responsible for the shortest bill and the longest bill in this session. So fortunately, this one's the short one and hopefully very straightforward for you. As Representative Nickel said, we just function as a pass-through for the collection and administration of this fee for appraisers. The Federal Commission does require that the state licensing function provide that service for appraisers in the state of Montana. We expect the fee to remain in place. If for some reason the federal government stopped the requirement, we would just simply stop assessing that fee and stop passing it through. So it was established in 2017 with the sunset date because we didn't quite know about it yet, but we're reasonably confident that it's going to stick around. So we're just asking for the removal of that sunset date so that we can continue administering that process. Happy to answer any questions and encourage a due pass. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Strauss. And just for the record, we do appreciate the shorter bills more than the, I've seen the big ones you've got coming forward. Are there other proponents? Other proponents, House Bill 67? Seeing none, are there any opponents? Any opponents? Seeing none. Informational witnesses? Seeing none. Questions from the committee? Questions from the committee? Seeing none. Representative Nickel, would you care to close on your bill?
I've prepared a 15-minute speech to...
Great.
No, I would just encourage a due pass on this. As we can tell, this is just cleanup, and we all like things neat and tidy around here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative. This will close the hearing on House Bill 67. Members of the committee, we have new computer systems. As I think we all know, it will take some time to switch from the system we're currently using into the system that's to be utilized for executive action. I do plan to call executive action at 20 after 10. Hopefully that'll give Yolanda enough time to switch systems over. We'll get faster as we do this more often. So we will stand in recess until 10:20, and we need everybody back in their seats at that time. James? The bill numbers eligible for executive action were the ones that we heard yesterday. We have House Bill 43. It does have an amendment that's been completed. We have House Bill 50 by Representative Brockman. There are no amendments. House Bill 43 was Representative Marshall's. House Bill 71 with one amendment from Representative Logie. And House Bill 98, which was my bill from yesterday, there are no amendments. So House Bill 43, 50, 71, and 98. We'll reconvene at 10:20. We're in recess. Will the members please take your seats? We'll end our recess back into House Business and Labor Committee. Members, we're about to go into executive action for the benefit of the new members. Once we go into executive action, the vice chair will move a bill, and we see on the board behind us the bills that we plan to move in executive action. Vice chair will move the bill. I will then ask for any discussion amongst the committee members. You can raise your hand. We'll recognize you. You can have your discussion on the bill. I like it. I hate it. I whatever. Or you can move an amendment. Amendments have already been passed out. That doesn't mean those amendments will actually be moved, but usually the person whose name is on top is sponsored or requested by will move the amendment. At that point, we'll discuss the amendment. We'll take a vote on the amendment. If it passes, we'll ask for other amendments. If pass or fails, we'll ask for other amendments. And after the amendments have completed, the vice chair will make a motion to pass the bill as amended. And then we'll have final discussion on the bill as amended. We'll take our vote. Okay. We know that we have one missing member, so there could potentially be proxies. If we take a vote and it's a voice vote and it's unanimous, don't feel like you have to bring the proxies forward. Unless that person absolutely wants their name on the record, you don't have to bring it forward. In fact, you don't ever have to bring the person's proxy forward unless they want it brought forward. So just know that it is not mandatory voting by all members at all time. Sometimes, especially on those voice votes, that doesn't matter. But I will ask for proxies after every vote in case someone wants to have someone's name read. Any questions on what we're about to do? Okay, we will open executive action. Vice Chair Siegenscroll.
Mr. Chair, I move due pass for House Bill 43.
You've heard the motion from the Vice Chair, due pass House Bill 43. This is Representative Marshall's bill. Representative Marshall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 43 amendment 43.001.001.
Members, you've heard the motion of Representative Marshall to move amendment 43.1.1. Representative Marshall, would you care to speak to your amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, all this amendment does simply is right there in the first section. It basically it took into consideration a lot of the concerns that everybody had yesterday on the opponents and just adds in the new section there for a designee of the appointed conservator, guardian, personal representative, executor, or administrator, or a trustee. This was one of the only major concerns that was brought up yesterday. So this fixes that problem. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Marshall. Is there discussion on the amendment? And this is just to the amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none, we'll call for the vote on the amendment. We'll try a voice vote. All those in favor of due pass amendment 43.1.1, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Are there any opposed? Are there any proxies? Okay, let the record reflect that the vote was posited by all members present and voting. Are there any other amendments? No other amendments. Vice Chair Siegenscroll.
Mr. Chair, I move due pass of House Bill 43 as amended.
Any discussion on the motion of due pass House Bill 43 as amended? Any discussion? Representative Bergstrom. On the mic, please. Microphone.
Chairman Buttrey, I have a question on our amendments here. We have a change from 60 days to 90 days. Is that does that need to be voted on as an amendment? Or at this point,
Jameson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as you'll recall from yesterday, there was a comment to extend the period from 60 days to 90 days. You'll see that on page 1, line 15. It's crossed off 60 and written in 90. That's in the amendment that the committee just voted on, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Yes, and thank you, Jameson. So anything that you see in red on the amended version, we used to call this a gray bill. And so this is the bill as it would look with the amendment incorporated, and everything you see in red is the amendment. So we just passed everything in red.
Okay. Thank you. Yep. Clarification.
Is there any other discussion on the bill as amended? Seeing none, I'll call for the question. Try a voice vote. Do pass House Bill 43 as once amended. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any proxies? Let the record reflect that House Bill 43 is amended, passed with positive vote of all members present and voting. Representative Marshall, this will now go to the floor. Congratulations. Vice Chair Siegenskroll.
Mr. Chair, I move due pass for House Bill 50.
Members of the committee, you've heard the motion of the due pass, House Bill 50, by Representative Brockman. Are there any amendments, Jameson? No amendments. This was the bill that revised alcohol laws for a restaurant and beer and wine licenses, removed an outdated exemption that no longer applies to RBW licenses. Any discussion on the motion to do pass House Bill 50? Any discussion? Seeing none, does anyone object to a voice vote? Okay, we'll try a voice vote. Do pass House Bill 50. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? Any proxies? Okay, House Bill 50 passes unanimous with members present and voting, and Representative Brockman's bill will go to the floor. Vice Chair Siegenskroll.
Mr. Chair, I move a due pass on House Bill 71.
Heard the motion of the Vice Chair, Representative Logie.
Mr. Chair, I would ask for a due pass on Amendment 81-001-001. And what this did, it was the department came back after they'd written the bill. They needed to make a few changes. And so once the bill had been submitted, this amendment comes into play after that. And it made a slight change to the title. And if you look back on page 3, it strikes out part of the original bill, Section 7. And then it added some additional criteria, and that you see is left open and underlined. And it was the department just wanted to clarify a little bit better on the criteria.
Members, you've heard the motion of Representative Logie to do pass Amendment 71.1.1. Is there discussion on the amendment? And you should have the gray bill in front of you. Any discussion on the amendment? Without objection, I'm going to have Jameson just go through the amendment to some extent. He is our technical expert, so we'll have him go through it and then ask for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I try not to talk too much, but just because this is our first time here with a big amendment, this will serve as some education here. You'll see on page 1 of the amendment, in the title, the committee is adding, or the amendment is proposing to add, allowing for the transfer of alcoholic beverage inventory with a bona fide sale if certain conditions are met. You'll see that in red and underlined. That gives you an idea of what the amendment is doing here. Also, on line 10, it says amending sections, and then you'll see in red 166303. That means that the bill is including another statute into the amendment, and you'll see that on page 8, lines 14 through 5 through 14. So the amendment is pulling in that new statute. The Department of Revenue technically said that in order to contemplate the changes made on page 3, it would make sense to include that statute as well. So the code kind of is in sync, or there aren't any internal consistencies in the code. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Jameson. Is there any discussion or comments on the motion to approve the amendment? Seeing none, we'll call for the question. We'll try a voice vote. All in favor, do pass amendment HB 71.1.1. Signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Are there any opposed? Any proxies? Okay, the amendment passes unanimously with members present voting. Any other amendments, Jameson? Nope. Vice Chair Siegenskroll?
Mr. Chair, I move due pass House Bill 71 as amended.
Heard the motion of the Vice Chair. Any discussion on House Bill 71 as once amended? Try a voice vote. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Any proxies? Okay, that motion passes unanimously with members present and voting. And Representative Logie, congratulations. This will go to the floor.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Siegenskroll.
Mr. Chair, I move due pass for House Bill 98.
Members, you've heard the motion of the Vice Chair. There are no amendments. House Bill 98 was my bill. This is dealing with suitable premises for alcohol licenses in airports. And as you heard in the discussion yesterday, there's an issue on one side of TSA and the other side of TSA because of the boundary requirements for alcohol licensing. This would basically take an airport facility and make that the licensed premise so that license could serve those alcoholic beverages across those TSA and other borders. There were no opponents to the bill. There's no amendments. I'll open up for discussion on House Bill 98. Mics are strange. Seeing none, call for the question. All those in favor do pass House Bill 98. Say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Any proxies? Let the record show that passed unanimously with members present voting, and this will go to the floor. Members, we will now close executive action. I would suggest you have four bills that we just passed. You may want to take those bills now and put them in your desk on the floor so that when these bills come up on the floor, you can open it up. If you feel like you want to speak for or against the bill, help the sponsor, whatever, this is the group that should be there. We have heard the testimony. We have more knowledge of these bills than most of the folks on the floor will be, so consider taking these up with you. Is there anything else to come before the Business and Labor Committee? Representative Marshall.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Did we go over about separating the folders and the bills, leaving sure. them out? For
yeah, we did a little bit of this yesterday. Representative Nickel, no, you leave the big brown folder here, but you can take the individual bill folders with you if you'd like. So what we do is if we've the bills we heard today, stick those in your brown big accordion folders so we have those available. We'll try to do exec on those in the near future. If you are not going to need the bill anymore, say that we've hit transmittal or maybe you're not going to speak to any of these bills on the floor, separate the paper from the folder and leave them outside of your big accordion folder. The staff will recycle the papers and they'll reuse the folders. So we want to be as friendly as we can to the trees. Any other discussion from the committee? Seeing none, we will adjourn House Business and Labor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.